Oh, actually, Espoo City was supposed to throw this big New Year's Eve party today, but it's cancelled now because of this.
Well, there we are. That was someone who works in the shop where the attack took place. Well, this year has been one of recession for all but a handful of countries after the most severe global economic crisis since the Second World War. But as we reach the end of 2009, just about every government is reporting some sort of an upsurge. So how serious is it? How deep is it? Well, my colleague Claire Balderson has been talking to three leading economists about the road to recovery. David Rosh, former chief economist at Morgan Stanley, now president of the Economic Analysts Independent Strategy, and Vince Cable, a Liberal Democratic Member of Parliament and the party's spokesman on the economy. He was also, I should say, a former chief economist at Shell, the oil company. And first, William White, chair of the Economic and Development Review Committee at the OECD. So just how bad does he think 2009 has been?
Well, it certainly has not been a very good year. I think the way in which the crisis spread from the financial side to the real side, the implications for job losses, the implications for output have been very severe. The last few months, I guess starting really in the spring, we heard a lot of talk about green shoots, and I guess the green shoots are still there. But looking forward, I would have a few doubts about the sustainability of all of this.
Because, David Roach, what has happened has been so deep and so painful for so many people, particularly when it comes to job losses?
Well, I think the problem is with the policies, really. What we've done is we have produced a huge rise in asset prices, very little real recovery in the economy, but at an enormous cost. And the cost is of adding a vast amount of government debt to the existing pile of consumer debt, which actually caused the crisis in the first place. To put it very succinctly, it's like giving heroin to a heroin addict in order to wean him off the drug. I don't think it's going to work in the long term.
Vincent Cable, how bad do you think 2009 has been for the global economy?
Well, I'll shift to a different metaphor. I mean, I think what's happened is the main Western economies, the US, UK and others, have suffered the economic equivalent of a massive heart attack. That was what happened when the financial system went down. But the patient's been kept alive. It's been fed with monetary steroids with unpredictable consequences. Now, in many parts of the world, there is real economic growth, but I think in the main Western economies, it's rather fragile, it's artificial, it's been supported by government deficits that are not sustainable and by monetary policy, which is going to have to be reversed.
And David Rose, you touched there on what the governments have done. Stimulus packages have been the order of the day, and in the UN's economic report of the 2nd of December, it says that everything would have been much worse without this government intervention, this government support. Stimulus packages of around $2.6 trillion over the year. But you don't think they've helped?
I'm not saying they haven't stopped the economies from falling further, but a lot of the government stimulus packages have been focused on preventing the consumer from moving from borrowing to thrift. There have simply been efforts to keep him spending, to keep him raising more debt, or to keep his current level of debt intact. I would say that if you want to have a healthy economic recovery, you first have to address the causes of the crisis. And most of the spending has actually been oriented towards maintaining the causes of the crisis because of the fear that trying to allow the consumer to adjust, to go through deleveraging, to have less debts, would be too painful. I actually think that if we had gone the right road, which was to let all this happen, we would have found that the economies might have moved down more sharply, but they would recover far more healthily.
I think the policymakers have been confronted with a real dilemma here, because in the back of most of their minds is this Keynesian theoretical framework that essentially says it's spending stupid. And so it was all shoulders to the wheel. It was fiscal policy, it was monetary policy, it was financial support. And I think it was effective in the sense that it avoided the worst. But I think David is absolutely right here that viewed from a rather longer-term perspective, fact of the matter is that all of these policies that have been followed have got very serious negative side effects going forward. What is lacking at the moment is this sense of urgency that there is this longer-term problem. It's the same problem that we've been through for the last 20 years, because this is about the fifth or sixth time there's been a major potential financial crisis, and every time the response has been the same. Print more money, accumulate more debt. And David's absolutely right. It's not sustainable. But, of course, the longer that you've been on the path, the more painful it is to actually take the hit and get onto a better path.
Which is why Vincent Cable presumably would have been politically completely unacceptable. It would have been political suicide for governments like the one in Britain, in the United States, anywhere, to do anything else.
You're right, and that the counterfactual case of just letting things happen was never going to be plausible and was never going to be done. And there was the horror of returning to the 1930s and all the problems associated with that, mass unemployment, economic nationalism, that stopped governments doing it. But I agree with your other contributors that we are doing things at the moment which are not sustainable, run the risk of repeating the problems of the past, asset bubbles are forming again, there is this great difficulty of exiting from this highly expansionary monetary policy. Nobody is addressing the fundamental issue of the imbalances between the savings surplus economies like China and the savings deficit countries like the United States and the UK. So those big problems are still out there.
David Roche, everyone talks about what kind of a recession this is going to be, whether we're going to come out of it in a U-shape, a W-shape, an L-shape, a double dip. Everyone has a different name for it. Looking ahead over 2010, what kind of a recovery, if there is a recovery, do you think it's going to be?
I don't have a good letter. I think it's just going to be lousy. I would suspect that the upside of this next year, the growth rate in the United States, will probably peter out to 1%, and at the downside, it'll probably be minus 1%. Either way, it's a bit of a statistical accident rather than an optimistic outcome. So I would have thought that the stimulus programs are going to have two negative effects. The first is, of course, they're going to run out of steam because they're limited in time, and if you want to create the same amount of stimulus next year and the same amount of growth next year as the stimulus program created this year, then you have to pass a stimulus program which is as big as the preceding one. It's the law of numbers, which is very interesting because it's physically impossible to do. So I think that'll run out. The other thing I think will run out is that it seems to me that people aren't completely foolish, and they realize that governments, by spending this amount of money, are actually going to increase their taxes in the future and probably lessen the amount of state pension funds they'll pay out. So to put it mildly, I would say the Western world, and of course Japan, has been basically lying like a dead duck in a pond for 10 years, and I would imagine it's going to repeat the exercise for an encore next year. The rich countries rather than the Western world are probably busy going nowhere, I would have thought.
Vincent Cable, you're in a country, or a politician in a country, where there is an awful lot of concern about government debt now and about how the government is going to pay for the recession, for the stimulus packages and all of that. How do you predict? What sort of shape, what letter do you give to recovery?
Well, I think a variation on the ones you started with. I think people talking about www.www, sort of bumping along on the bottom. There is a remarkable degree of consensus in the political establishment here that the enormous government borrowing is going to have to be cut. The argument is about when, where and how, but it's going to have to happen. And there's going to be 5 years of very hard slog while whichever government is voted in, probably in May, is going to be cutting public spending and increasing taxes, and we're going to have an economy that's not growing very rapidly. It's going to be a half decade or more of considerable economic gloom.
William White, are you as pessimistic?
I wish I could be much more optimistic. What this boom did over the course of the last number of years, it encouraged the growth of a lot of industries that will now have to seriously cut back because there's no foreseeable demand. And I'm thinking here in terms of cars, I'm thinking construction, I'm thinking retail and wholesale distribution. There's a whole host of these industries that are too big. And all the while the readjustment is taking place, those industries are getting smaller. The unemployment rate, the so-called natural rate, is going to be higher than it would otherwise have been. The fundamental imbalance between the Western countries and Asia has not been dealt with. And that imbalance is that those Asian countries are all geared up to export something that the people in the Western countries can no longer afford to buy. And so we have a real misallocation problem there too, which is going to take some years to work itself out.
And that was William White, who's with the OECD, and we also heard from Vince Cable from the opposition Liberal Democrats here in the UK, and David Roche, who is now president of Independent Strategy. You're listening to the BBC World Service. This is Owen Bennett-Jones with NewsHour. Some headlines. The American CIA has acknowledged that 7 of its employees were killed in Wednesday's suicide attack in Afghanistan, but it is not releasing their names or giving details of their work. A new free trade area, the largest in terms of population in the world, is coming into effect in East Asia. And a gunman in Finland has killed 5 people, 4 of them in a shooting at a shopping centre, before apparently committing suicide. And we've been getting some emails about that. This from someone who lives in that town, Kathy Rose. "This is so sad. We live only a few blocks away and felt this was the safest place on earth. This is a time for mourning and praying. The praying should never stop." And Tony, who's actually from the UK, but who's staying in this town with his son, he says, "My wife and I went shopping and we were just heading back to the car park when we saw Prisma staff and colleagues entering our part of the complex, and most were calm, but some distraught and had to sit down to gather themselves, and armed police were gathering and other areas being vacated by confused shoppers. And someone else who was there, I went to the shopping centre to buy a few last things before the new year. It was closed down with police cars and helicopters patrolling the area." So there we are, everyone affected by what happened. And if you've got any eyewitness account, world have your say at bbc.com. Now, it doesn't matter where you are on Earth, really. It is a universal feature of human society that children get sung to sleep. At least it always has been the case. It seems that lullabies are under threat in many parts of the developed world. They're simply being forgotten. But Nick Thorpe, who's our East European correspondent, is, it turns out, a bit of a lullaby expert. He's been, over the years, recording lullabies in Central and Eastern Europe. So, why the fascination?
I suppose, first of all, Tom, it's a personal interest. I do have 5 children, 5 sons of my own, so we've had trouble getting them to sleep over the years. There's also, I think, a professional, well, I suppose partly a professional interest, that so often as a journalist one is chasing wars or conflict of one type or another. And actually, I found myself asking at the end of a day, especially in poorer villages out in the sticks, does anyone in this village know any good lullabies? And more often than not, someone does. More recently, I've actually started tracking down ethnologists who specialise in the subject. And what they say is, I find rather interesting. One example is the words actually used in lullabies. Obviously, these are often made-up words, but they're clearly specifically designed to lull the baby to sleep. For example, exactly this word lull, lullaby in English. There's a word lilai, lulai in Slovak, in Czech, in Polish, lulla in Norwegian. Here's a Katalin Juhas. She's a Hungarian folk singer and ethnographer. She's singing a traditional lullaby accompanied by her 3-month-old son. That was Katalin Juhas there singing a well-known Hungarian lullaby called Beli Buba. She was speaking about those special lullaby words I mentioned before. Another example from the south of Europe, there's a kind of ninanana sound, which is apparently very common in the south of Europe, in Italy, Greece, Bulgaria, even in Arabic lullabies. Here you can hear it distinctly in the following lullaby, which I recorded in northern Mitrovica. It's sung by a young Kosovo-Albanian gypsy woman living in pretty bad conditions in northern Mitrovica in Kosovo. The words are one thing, but the melodies, the tunes, in a sense, are even more interesting. Gerge Agoc is another Hungarian ethnographer who makes frequent trips collecting folk songs. Here's one he recorded among the Karachai people of the North Caucasus. And what's really exciting when you listen to this is it's the same tune still being sung in Hungarian in a traditional folk song. You can judge this for yourself, but immediately after the song which he recorded again in the North Caucasus, he sings the modern Hungarian equivalent, so obviously with very different words, but with the same melody. Why this is so interesting to me anyway is that the Hungarian tribes may have picked this up more than 1,000 years ago during their migration westwards to Europe from Central Asia. But on my travels, I do still find people who know the old songs, especially in very poor districts. Here's one of my favourites from my own sound archive. It's an elderly gypsy woman from a village in southern Hungary. She sings in the Bayash language, and before she began, she said, we couldn't expect her to sing a lullaby unless she had a baby. So she asked for a baby. A tiny baby was immediately produced, put into her arms. And I have to say, this lullaby was successful. The baby in her arms fell asleep immediately.
M-a lăsat-o sărăcia, Dubai, Dubai.
Nick Thorpe there, recording a universal tradition. Russia has been urging revelers celebrating the new year in saunas to refrain from popping open the champagne until they've left the steam house, warning it could prove fatal. The emergencies minister, whose name is Sergei Shoigu, said, "I'd like to make the following recommendation: drink after being in the sauna, not when inside." Well, earlier I discussed this with Ossi Avila from Finland, who is head of the Sauna World Championships, which sort of begs a question in itself, really. So I began by asking him, what on earth is that?
Well, basically, it's the hottest competition in the world, you may say. We have a sauna warmed up to 110 degrees, and basically we want to know who can stay in the longest.
Well, what's the world record?
It's hard to tell because every sauna is a bit different, but these best guys have been there over 15 minutes even.
15 minutes?
Yeah.
That doesn't sound terribly long. How hot was it?
It's over 110 degrees. You must try it out if you think that it's not so hot.
You don't think I'll manage? Okay. Right. Well, okay. Well, so that's your sort of your day job. But on your advice about drinking in a sauna, is it a bad idea?
Yes, you can say that it is a bad idea, because after all, the sauna is about relaxation, and of course I understand that some people like to relax with a little help from our good friend alcohol, but it's not a very good combination. A few beers, that's not so bad thing. It's actually part of Finnish sauna culture. But being drunk in a sauna, that's not good because it's very bad for your heart, for example.
Well, let's be honest, if you're only in for 15 minutes, you can't drink that much, can you?
Yeah, but when you go in for several times, then you can spend inside the sauna for an hour and a half easily.
I see.
So if you take something before, something during and something after, so yes. it might be...